America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, a spiritual leader, a civil rights icon, and an organizer who empowered Black Americans to build their political power from even the earlier days of his activism in the 60s and 70s.
I am Black, beautiful. I must be respected. I must be protected. I am somebody.
Fast forward to 1988, and Jackson, after losing his bid to be the Democratic nominee for president, took the stage at that year's DNC with words that would echo far beyond the campaign.
When we divide, we cannot win. We must find common ground as a basis for survival and development and change and growth.
Today, we're looking back at that pivotal era through the eyes of journalist and CNN anchor Abby Phillip. Her new book, A Dream Deferred, explores how Jackson's two presidential campaigns in the 80s reshaped American politics. In this next conversation with Abby Phillip, we'll dig into what Jackson's story reveals about the ongoing struggle for representation and power. Abby Phillip started with what drew her to write her first book about the Reverend Jesse Jackson in the first place.
Well, the first thing is just history. I am a journalist, and so I've been covering politics my entire career. And there is so much history that needs to be told. And I was surprised that this chapter of Reverend Jackson's life had not really been fully explored, especially given all that has happened in the last, let's just call it 25 years of politics.
Yeah.
And even more has passed since these campaigns actually happened. And post Barack Obama, post even now Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, I think that there is a real need to take a look back at this time and ask the question, was Jesse Jackson a man before his time? Mm. And I don't think that he's been viewed that way. But now I think is a good moment to recognize that so many of the themes that he ran on in the 1980s that were seen as radical have actually become part of the mainstream today. And he also changed the structure of the Democratic Party and its politics in some really key ways that perhaps we'll get into that I think also it took 30 or 40 years for all of that to really be seen in our politics.
Yeah, to that end, you write about how his two presidential campaigns in 1984 and 88, how they sort of set this series of events in motion. Yeah. You write in the book, it would, quote, fundamentally change the Democratic Party forever. And I thought that that was so strong. Let's hear a little bit from his speech back in 84 at the DNC. This was what he had to say to young voters.
I just want young America to do me one favor. Just one favor. Exercise the right to dream. You must face reality, that which is. But then dream of the reality that ought to be, that must be. Live beyond the pain of reality with the dream of a bright tomorrow. Use hope and imagination as weapons of survival and progress. Use love to motivate you and obligate you to serve the human family. Young America, dream!
That fire and that passion,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what sticks from the 80s.
Absolutely. I mean, he is one of the greatest orators, I think, of the last century and perhaps even the current century.
Yeah.
And you hear those themes of dream.
Mm-hmm.
Those are themes that Barack Obama picked up when he ran a campaign of hope and change. I mean, I think everybody remembers Jesse Jackson talking about keep hope alive.
Yes, absolutely.
The themes really carry through. And he also did not skip over accountability. You know, when he spoke to young people, young high school students and middle school students, mm-hmm. he talked about, going away from drugs and moving to education and things that are, you know, better for your community. He didn't really skip over the part where he asked people to do better and to be better.
Yeah.
And also to hope for a different future than they might currently be able to imagine.
Yeah. Are you seeing Jesse Jackson's influence today then in just how Democrats approach Black voter engagement and just messaging overall today?
Well, I think that there is a lot that I think current leaders can learn from what he did, because I do think that he both spoke to the current situation that Black people faced, which back in the 80s was worse than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke to the destitution, the sense of economic abandonment, political abandonment. But he also said to Black Americans, you are somebody. He said to them they could be more than they are. He asked them to walk away from drugs and violence. There was both a desire to say there is a responsibility that you have mm-hmm. and then a responsibility that we have to you. So I think there's that. But also what he did for Black voters is he said to them, you have power
yeah.
in your vote. He registered millions of voters all across the country in a massive voter registration campaign. And I heard you talking to the Reverend earlier
yes.
in the program, and she had exactly the right analogy. He gave this speech, and he did it in a lot of his speeches. He talked about a David and Goliath struggle. The rocks just laying around were all of the unregistered voters, Black voters, but yeah. all voters, unregistered voters, who had not really fully realized their voting power. And he said, if only David could pick up those stones. He could defeat Goliath. And I think that empowerment was something that was really powerful for Black Americans at that time.
Let's go back to talking about Barack Obama, because I remember the iconic image, and a lot of people remember this, of the tears that were running down Jesse Jackson's face that night
yeah.
when Barack Obama was elected our country's first Black president. But when you think about what was behind those tears, I'm thinking about from Obama's Senate win to that presidential win, a lot of ups and downs, I would yeah. say, maybe in their relationship and how things were perceived. Talk more about what was really behind those tears, you think, for Reverend Jackson.
Yeah. I mean, well, Reverend Jackson has been around since the 1960s. He was there on the day, on the site of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about that journey between Dr. King's assassination and Barack Obama's election was 40 years. So as someone put it to me, that was 40 years in the wilderness for mm-hmm. Black voters. And I think Reverend Jackson's tears were not just about his relationship with Barack Obama. It was also about all that he tried to achieve personally and couldn't. It was also about what Dr. King tried to achieve and was killed before he could achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much fear in so many of the figures that I spoke to for this book about
yeah.
what it's like to be a prominent Black political figure in this country. And for those 40 years, what it was like was fear of being killed. And I think for Jesse Jackson to see Barack Obama win that election and be alive for that moment.
Yes.
I think that the tears were not just about their at times strained relationship. It was also about actually seeing that moment happen.
I think there was a bit of disbelief in there.
Disbelief.
It's happening. It's
finally
happening.
It had been truncated. That hope had been truncated for so many Americans so many times.
Yeah.
It was truncated for him. And yes, you're right. Their relationship has been very up and down, very publicly so. Comments that Reverend Jackson made about Barack Obama.
Which weren't supposed to be public.
Yeah, which weren't supposed to be public. And basically privately reprimanding him for how he spoke to Black people. And later on, Reverend Jackson said, I so regret saying that. He had so much deep regret. And mm-hmm. I think there was regret in those tears too.
Yeah.
So yes, the relationship was strained. And I think for everybody around them, it's so unfortunate because there is a direct line between Reverend Jackson and Barack Obama that one could not have existed without the other.
Yeah, I love the way you sort of thread the needle in this book. You interviewed Jackson himself during COVID, right? You came here to Chicago. You went to the Rainbow Push headquarters. What stood out to you then, Abby? I mean, because you got to step so closely inside his political world at that time. And you were writing about like observations with the staffers and how they were as well.
I mean, it's so fascinating to be around someone who has been in political life for as, I shouldn't even say political life, public life.
Right.
For as long as he has been. And he just, his world does revolve around him, like so many prominent people like him. But even in his older age, I mean, he's been battling a neurodegenerative disease for many years now. And at that time, he was sort of in the middle of that journey. And I think I knew the time was of the essence to really get as much from him as I could. While he could still speak, while he could still communicate well.
Was it difficult to have the conversation?
Yeah. I mean, he's always had a very strong Southern accent, and he had a stutter as a child. And so I think he's always had a way of speaking that I think some people found difficult to understand, but it's been made more difficult as the years have passed. But I was shocked by how good his memory was.
Really?
I mean, he remembered so much. Almost everything, and had such granular detail. And also, he didn't like to talk very much about tactics and about even his feelings about certain things. He was very thematic. He talked a lot about power, mm-hmm. about empowerment, about the goal of his campaigns being to show people what their vote could do, being that goal being to show the Democratic Party that they had to do more than just pander mm-hmm. to voters of color. So he had a very kind of strong sense of what he wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, largely unchanged from how he's been for many, many years. And when I went with him to his hometown in Greensboro, South Carolina, we drove around in a car to around his neighborhood, and he was giving turn-by-turn directions. Turn right, turn left, and this is where I grew up. This is where I went to school.
Like
this
he didn't
is
my skip high a beat. School.
Didn't skip a beat, and that was amazing to see.
Yeah. So Chicago, I think it's easy to say, made Jesse Jackson, right? But it also challenged him.
Yes.
What did you learn about how this city's politics, its big personalities, and the power that lies here in Chicago, and the power struggles, how all of that defined who Jesse Jackson became as this national figure?
You're so right to say that this city made him, because this is where he was given a task by Dr. King to create Operation Breadbasket, which was the economic arm of the SCLC, the Southern Leadership Christian Coalition. And that was the first time that that organization had really said, we're going to go into specific cities and we're going to build up coalition politics, not just around basic rights like the right to vote or the right to walk into an establishment and sit at the counter, but of the right to participate in the economic life of a community. And Jesse Jackson was extremely successful in that task. But then after Dr. King died, he tried to turn his attention to politics, and he was set back by the Chicago machine mm-hmm. at the time, by Mayor Daley, who was an incredibly powerful political force. And at that time, you know, Black voters in Chicago were a part of the machine, but they weren't empowered by the machine. And so it was a more than 20-year struggle, you know, between when, you know, let's call it 1970 to 1983, when Harold Washington was elected, for that to really come to fruition. And one question that I had for Reverend Jackson was, why didn't you ever really run for mayor of this city? Because it would seem logical right. that he might want to run a city that he was such a part of, that he had actually so much power in. Well, I think the answer was that he did not see himself as a politician for a very long time.
Interesting.
That even his political advisors kind of proposed to him on several occasions, here's how you could do it, here's what it would look like. He saw himself as a religious leader, as an organizer. One of his more famous rhyming quotes that people often cite is, he used to say he was the jelly shaker, not the jelly maker. So there was something about him that he felt like his job was to rally, to shake the establishment, to get them to pay attention, and other people would make the sausage. It wasn't until he ran for president that he really fully contemplated what it would be like to have to actually run something in politics and not just be a religious leader, but a political leader, a movement leader.
Yeah. And as we've kind of already discussed, I mean, there's no historical figure, especially one as grand as Jesse Jackson, that is without any kind of tension or somewhat complicated story when you sum it all up. As you were writing the book, Abby, what were maybe his most challenging life moments that you maybe wondered whether or how to include?
Well, the most pivotal moment of controversy in these campaigns came in the 1984 campaign. This was at almost the beginning of 1984, when it was revealed that he had used the term Hymietown in a private conversation. And that is, for those who don't know, a kind of, I guess, somewhat old-time slur against Jewish people. That was, I think, an unavoidable part of his history to write about, because you can't tell the story of the 1984 campaign without telling the story of what happened when he had to confront that. And it was really, I think, a story of his decision to first deny that he said it and then own up to it. And dealing with some of the figures, the controversial figures around him, like Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam leader, who made it even more difficult for him to move past it. And even before those campaigns, he had struggled with his relationship with Jewish American leaders. And that's because of his support for the Palestinian cause. And so that drama in the 1984 campaign is the principal drama of that campaign. And the way I like to frame it is that he started out that campaign actually at an enormous high. He had just come back from Syria, where he went to the Middle East and single-handedly brought back an American prisoner of war who was being held captive by the Assad regime when the Reagan administration couldn't do it. He came back home to a hero's welcome. Ronald Reagan invited him to the White House. And that's how he started the 1984 campaign. It was the kind of press that any candidate would have only dreamed
of.
What a massive high. It had not been seen before, and it has not been seen again. Since that a candidate would do something like that. And then just a few weeks after that high, the Hymietown controversy explodes, and he was never able to get past it. But what I will say, Sasha, is that he gave a speech at a synagogue in New Hampshire, explaining and apologizing for those comments.
Yeah,
and it was one of those moments when, having covered several campaigns in this modern time. And I'm sure you remember when President Obama had to give that big speech about race after, Reverend Wright was revealed to be his pastor and all of that controversy. Mm-hmm. And that speech was such a pivotal moment for his campaign. This speech for Jesse Jackson at the synagogue was a very similar moment. But because of the media environment, I think it did not get that far.
Yeah.
A lot of Americans didn't hear the apology. They didn't hear the contrition. They didn't hear him use this really powerful analogy of Jacob wrestling with the angel in the Bible,
right,
and how he had fallen short. And I think that in part because of that, it did not allow him really to move past that moment.
Yeah. And as I hear you talk about that, Abby, I think about that final chapter in your book, appropriately titled Legacy.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a single moment of Jesse Jackson's life that, well, I will certainly now always reflect on after hearing you sort of lay that out for us. This is the first stop of your book tour, but I wonder how it feels so far. Yeah. This is new to you.
Yeah, it's new to be on the other side of asking
it
questions
is.
For sure. And this book I've been working on for so long, unspooling this really complex legacy is obviously really challenging.
But I think your political reporter instincts got you through.
And I want people to know about this book that, I spent time with Reverend Jackson and his family in writing the book, and I wanted it to really reflect the people who actually were there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a piece of journalism, and it tells a real story, not one that's overly, saccharine or papers over anything. But it's also focused on, I think, a part of his life that I think most people don't know very much about.
Yeah.
They might remember those campaigns, but they don't know, I think, as much about them as I think we ought to know.
Oh, yeah,
because,
you go inside.
Yeah,
for
and
sure.
There are so many lessons for right now.
Yeah.
I mean, even, I finished writing the book earlier this year before a lot of this happened.
Yeah.
And Zohran Mamdani running in New York
is
a perfect example of a very Jacksonian candidate and a very Jacksonian campaign. Even recently, a week
ago.
We'll
have to wrap in just a second.
Yeah, he had he used a Jesse Jackson slogan, "Our time has come." So there are lots of echoes these days.
The influence just being felt all over. Abby Phillips, CNN news anchor and author of A Dream Deferred, Jesse Jackson and the Fight for Black Political Power. It'll be released next Tuesday, October 28th, wherever books are sold. Abby, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just a cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
Okay, now it's time to catch you up on the big stories of the day. We checked in with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, and we started off with the massive No Kings protests where tens of thousands of people marched through downtown Chicago. Here's Claire.
Yeah, I mean, it was a two-mile stretch, lots of speakers beforehand. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson gave a pretty compelling speech. Protesters, for the most part, very, very, very peaceful. That was sort of the state of affairs here in the Chicago area, as well as across the country. Here in Chicago, folks were wearing inflatable costumes, lots of homemade signs. There was actually a very large replica of the Constitution. About six people were carrying that.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Also, a big protest in West Suburban Oak Park, also Highland Park to the north, saw lots of people. Plenty of photos online, too, WBEZ.org for folks to check out.
So not just downtown. And it seems like it brought out the young, the old, and everything in between.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing. The last protest that we had, as we know, the first rally, nearly 15,000 people, all walks of life, shapes, sizes, and colors in downtown Chicago.
Yeah. And in case folks missed this on Friday, deployment of the National Guard in Chicago is still on hold. But President Trump is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to allow it. This is after lower courts said no. So we'll continue to, of course, bring you the very latest on that ever-developing story. Now, speaking of using your voice, Claire, I mean, Gen Z violence prevention leaders from across the U.S., they were here in Chicago this weekend.
Yeah, they were here on Saturday, essentially, to devise a new campaign, come up with some ideas, a roundtable for Project Unloaded. That's a nonprofit geared toward getting guns out of the hands of teens. A bunch of local teens participated, including some from Kenwood Academy on the city's south side. WBEZ spoke to a young gentleman saying he was motivated to join this after two of his schoolmates were fatally shot.
We got a new role for Stacey Davis Gates. She's president of the Chicago Teachers Union, but now
she's staying very busy. Davis Gates was elected president this weekend of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. She says she's going to continue to lead the Chicago Teachers Union, but she also says having the, quote, 100,000 members of the statewide union now behind her is going to help. She sees the IFT as advocates for more funding for schools and colleges, as well as fixes to their pension systems. The Illinois Federation of Teachers also trains and supports members as they negotiate contracts. So some, though, have questioned how Davis Gates and the CTU's tactics will play out in the suburbs as well as downstate. So certainly more to come on this from WBEZ's education desk.
Yeah, she seems very pumped about the role. She said, quote, we have to show people how to practice democracy, how to work across our differences, how to create solidarity based on our collective needs. And I don't think it's a better place to do that than with teachers from all over the state. So we'll keep an eye on Stacey Davis Gates. The Bears, also keeping an eye on them. 4-2, Claire?
Yes, it was a bit of a sloppy game. Yesterday, our sports contributor, Cheryl Ray Stout, actually called it. The Bears were winning ugly against the Saints. Cold, wet, rainy morning. There were a few turnovers. Many of them favored the Bears, though, and their defense.
Hey, a win is a win.
That's right. We had a monster game. Four takeaways, four sacks. Caleb Williams, Bears quarterback, finished 15 of 26 for 172 yards. He had one touchdown and just one interception.
All righty.
So they've now won four in a row. We'll take
it. Yes. And you know, normally on Mondays we do this, Claire, with our colleague Mike Puente. He's actually off today, but I know he's happy wherever he is.
Yeah, he's smiling.
Before I let you go, Claire, what else are you watching?
Just Chicago now has a George Went Way. This was celebrated over the weekend, an honorary street sign unveiled in Beverly on the far south side. That's actually where Went was born and raised, best known for his role as Norm on the sitcom Cheers. It sounds like more than 100 people turned out for this. Went, as we know, died in May at the age of 76, but now being commemorated in Beverly.
Nice. WBEZ's Claire Lane. Thank you for the update.
Thank you.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, just head to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.